to Digging a Hole, the Legal Theory Podcast. On this podcast, my co-host, Sam Moyne, and I, David Schleicher, talk about legal theory and whatever else is on our mind. Sam, how are things in jolly old England?
Oh, it's amazing. You know, I'm podcasting from the pub.
There you go. It is a cold, dreary day here, so I feel like I kind of feel your pain. It's raining, and I'm drinking warm ale. So
I've sent you my weather because it's a sunny day here, and everyone's out and about. Usually, they're getting wasted as the drizzle falls.
So given that we are recording from our basements, that we have something happy to look forward to. Who's joining us today? It's a pretty exciting episode.
It's a calm conversation, David, but it's an absolute barn burner. I mean, I'm reeling, to be honest, and I hope others like it. We have invited on our treasured colleague and Supreme Court chronicler, Linda Greenhouse, who has published a new book on the last term of the Supreme Court's work. And yet we not only get into that, but into the broadest issues about the Supreme Court's role in our democracy. And I encourage you to listen carefully to what Linda says.
Yeah, absolutely. It was a fascinating episode with really one of our one of the great, maybe the greatest journalist about the Supreme Court we have. And so with that, let's get into it. All right, let's get started. I'm so excited for this episode. So we have with us Linda Greenhouse, whose official title is the Clinical Lecturer in Law and Senior Research Scholar in Law at Yale Law School, and also a columnist for the New York Times about law. Linda first came into my life through kind of yellowed clips of her coverage of Albany and the fiscal crisis in New York in the 1970s, which were honestly everywhere in my house when I was growing up. It tells you a lot about my childhood. But Linda has covered the Supreme Court as a kind of reporter for the New York Times from 1978 to 2008, and has since written a biweekly column on law and particularly about the Supreme Court. And we're here to talk about her fascinating new book, Justice on the Brink. So welcome to the pod.
Pleasure to be here.
Linda, it's amazing to have you on, and the book is such a wonderful read. You know, we would be shocked if it weren't as well written as it is. But what I wanted to ask you first is to talk about how you approached it, because it's sort of in a different genre, not only from prior books, but maybe any book, because you wrote the sections of it. And then you, in a sense, refuse to revise them once you learn new things as time passed. And I'm just curious if you could lay out kind of the basics of the project, and in particular, how you decided to make it almost like a journal where you're not allowed to go back and kind of bring it up in each section up to the present.
Oh, thanks for picking up on that, Sam. I guess it's very shocking to a lifelong academic, because my observation is academics never stop revising until the final footnote dies or whatever. So I did approach this journalistically, and in a way that reflected back on my very first book about 15 years ago, a book called Becoming Justice Blackmun, which was a kind of a biography of Justice Harry Blackmun based exclusively really on his papers that had just opened at the Library of Congress. And the reason the two projects are the same is that I was then a full-time reporter for the New York Times, and they gave me a summer off to write the book. Okay. So I had, from the time the court finished its term at the end of June until the first Monday of October. And so I had to turn it in chapters so that the publisher could publish it. I didn't have the luxury. So this project, Justice on the Brink, came to me, Random House, made me an offer I couldn't refuse around November of 2020. Amy Coney Barrett had been, I guess, wasn't even quite confirmed. I guess she had been confirmed 8 days before the election in November of 2020. And the idea was to write a book that would chronicle October term 2020 with the three Trump justices and just see where that took the court and the country. And they wanted to publish it as close as possible to the first Monday in October of 2021. So that's pretty quick. And of course, my first reaction to this proposal was, you know, how can I do this? There's a pandemic on. I can't get down to the court. I'm living in Western Massachusetts. Like, what's the deal with this? And then I realized, of course, nobody could get to the court because the court was closed. And the justices weren't at the court. They were conducting oral argument on their home telephone lines. So I was not at the kind of disadvantage, you know, fatal disadvantage that I would have been at if the whole rest of the world was watching the court in action. So that was reassuring. And the idea was I would turn it in chapter by chapter, month by month. And so, you know, each chapter was... you know, I guess source cited would be the jargon, and copy edited and basically put to bed as I was writing the next one. So, you know, that was a little bit of Gus Ball that I think would, you know, shake the self-confidence of most academics. But, you know, of course, I was used to that from my life as a journalist because, you know, you draw certain conclusions or inferences from something you see, and it's in the actual hard newspaper. Not that you all read the hard newspaper anymore, but I still do, and people do, in print.
Oh, we're old school on this pod. We get many newspapers.
Well, that's good. So you know, I mean, I'll just digress for a second. So David mentioned my career covering Albany. So, you know, one thing that was reassuring about writing about politics and covering Albany during the New York fiscal crisis was extremely exciting for a baby reporter and, you know, a little bit frightening because things would happen between midnight and 3 o'clock in the morning, the most important things. And, you know, you just had to rush it into the, you know, what they would call the one dot final of the Times. It closed at, I think, 2:45 in the morning, whatever. But the comforting thing about covering politics is, you know, you could be wrong in the morning, but right by the afternoon, it's a moving target. I got to the court and it quickly occurred to me, you know, you could be wrong. You could say something and, you know, it's just not correct. So that, you know, but over 30 years of covering the court, I got used to that knowledge, background knowledge. And I think I brought that kind of self-confidence to the book project.
Okay. That was really interesting, but let me just make sure I understand or press you either one or the other. I mean, I get that in the, you know, the Blackmun book, that there was a kind of such a short time horizon. There's a mad dash to finish, and it made sense to send ahead the chapters. But in this case, you had a year. I get that, you know, the pieces were being subsided and edited, but there was nothing forbidding you going back and, you know, changing a few things, but you didn't let yourself in as time passed. And it was almost like there was a kind of, you know, principled decision to kind of have your thinking unfold in real time and show us that, you know, what it was like in a sense, not to get to kind of provide us a kind of with something that is brought in which every part is brought up to the, you know, to currency at the time of the deadline. So it seems like there's something new here that's not just accounted for by the mad dash. Especially since it was, you know, such a long period of writing, unlike the prior book.
Well, not such a long period because my deadline was July 31st. They wanted to make it July 1st. I said, hey, the term's not going to end July 1st. Right. So can I have it till July 31st, please? So in a way, I guess I was kind of playing a game with myself. You know, readers were not going to get a long view of the term. So what they might as well get was the term according to me. And, you know, there's no first person in the book, but I think there is definitely an authorial voice, and it's mine. And so, you know, just kind of let it rip you know, respond to the argument. I mean, I'm sorry I didn't pick up in the Affordable Care Act argument in November that the case was going to go off on standing. Silly me, I thought it was going to go off on its lack of merit. But, you know, that's okay. And I think if readers come to it, I don't know exactly, my ideal reader would sort of not be you and David. It would be, you know, my smart neighbor down the street that doesn't know much about the court, but kind of is intrigued enough to pick up the book. They'll see that it's not, the life of the Supreme Court is not scripted. Everything is a moving target to some degree. And so I guess kind of instinctively, I thought the most honest way to approach it, since I wasn't going to have the luxury on that time frame, the July 31st, to go back and clean everything up, it would just be more fun and maybe more interesting and maybe more authentic to do it the way I did it.
Yeah. Speaking of your ideal audience, I gave my copy of the book to one of your biggest fans, is my mom. So she's very excited about it. She fits your model perfectly. So I actually thought one of the more interesting methodological things, we'll get into some of the substance in a minute, or this will bridge that, is that it's not really reported. It's kind of like you're like reading the opinions and kind of coming up. It's not like a inside baseball in the sense, and you should note that nobody could have that inside baseball because it was all, everyone was just kind of sitting on Zoom in their pajamas or whatever. But it seemed to me that the method matched one of the themes in the book, which is like a debate about whether the court should be public facing, or the way in which it should be public facing, or is it and between those who are more public facing and those who are kind of more focused on inside baseball. For instance, you write about the late Lonnie Guinier's essay on demisprudence, Justice Sotomayor's very public jurisprudence, the logic behind Justice Alito's kind of famous or infamous FedSoc gala speech, and kind of the influence of Justice Thomas's dissent in conservative circles. And you kind of put this in some conflict with Justice Kagan and Justice Roberts, who are kind of more internal looking, at least as you describe them, and as the last chapter, which I think is the most interesting chapter of the work, which is that you it's called the breaking of the fourth wall. You seem to suggest that the story is about the kind of breaking of the internal narrative of the court, or that the court can't continue going on pretending like it is somehow kind of removed from our crazy polarization and politics. Is this the right reading of the book? Is what's really on the brink the idea of a court that's separate from politics in some way, and that the future is that the justices will, like, opinions will be aimed at exclusively at getting on television, and that the kind of internal politics is going to become less important. And so the proper way to read the court is from Western Massachusetts and not from reporting in Washington.
That's really nice, David. Thank you. I hadn't actually thought of it quite that way. But you may well be right. I think it's not so much that they'll write opinions to go on television. They write opinions aimed at specific audiences, at motivating and mobilizing specific bases. So I think that's certainly what Alito's been doing for years. You know, I mean, when I've taught my sort of basic Supreme Court class, which I call the Institutional Supreme Court, I've, you know, always included Alito's what I call "bring me a case" statements or dissents concerning denial of cert. You know, gee, this case just didn't quite make it, but bring me a better case. I'm here for you. So I think there's more of that. There's Sonia Sotomayor's voice, who's speaking, I think, not so much to a base, but I think I say this explicitly, to history. That she can't control the course of events, but she wants to make damn sure that history notes and remembers what was occurring. So the breaking of the fourth wall is a kind of a Sam Moynish maybe overture, you know, that I came to not from theory, but from observation. So So yeah, I like that. Thank you.
So I also want to ask, you know, kind of what is the brink of? I mean, we're already starting to get into it, whether it's a transition from a court that was apolitical in some sense to one that is political or openly political. But I want to kind of focus the question first on kind of timing, because this is an account of one term. And the brink is then this one term when it seems like we're in suspense. Now, of course, one could argue, as Noah Feldman did in that New York Times review, that in a sense, you're too early. I think, you know, you can plausibly respond that, you know, everything's being set up for what we're seeing this term. And it's fair to say that the term you covered is the brink. But I want to actually kind of worry that it's the reverse, that, you know, why wasn't the brink, you know, Richard Nixon's appointments? Or why wasn't the brink any number of other times in between then and now? You know, my analogy for, you know, we liberals is that we you know, we're like the, you know, the frog in the hot water as it boils, never jumping out. And if that's true, it seems like this last term is a really late one to say justice is on the brink. And so I'd just like to get you to respond to that. Like, what is that, if Noah's wrong, is that right? That, you know, it's been a really long brink, and by some accounts, we've been over it for a while.
Yeah, that's really interesting, Sam. Let me say a couple of things. One, the Noah Feldman review, which angered me deeply, struck me as one of the most ignorant pieces of writing about the court by somebody with tenure at Harvard Law School that I could imagine.
That's saying something. Sorry.
I see it as saying something very deliberately, because, of course, what I'm describing in OT20 was the court setting its agenda, using its new power to set the agenda. Certainly, Noah Feldman realizes that one of the most important things, albeit one of the less transparent things that the court does, is set its agenda through its disposition of its certiorari power, right? And of course, when the court sets its agenda, it's setting our agenda, we the citizens. It sets our political agenda. It sets our social and cultural agenda. That's why we're all talking about abortion right now, right? And so, you know, the May chapter, the chapter of the month of May, the first line is, I believe, it was always about abortion. And it describes how the court, now, I don't know what was happening inside the conference, but I know from, you know, objective evidence that the court took the Mississippi cert petition to conference week after week after week after week before finally granting it. So something very interesting was going on. I wish I knew what it was, but we know how consequential it was. It was a totally gratuitous, aggressive, you know, power mad grant of cert. So that's my response to Feldman. To the question of the brink, I mean, it's so interesting because I'm currently, I probably shouldn't say this, but I'll say it, working on a piece for the New York Review of Books where I have undertaken to review the report of the President's Commission as a book, right? I did that for them with the Mueller report on the Russia question. And it's kind of a fun construct for them, you know, so obviously it's not simply, you know, here's what the report says. And what I'm trying to say is what the commission, not the report, but the voices that reached the commission, including yours, what they drive to the surface is the end of the romance, end of the Supreme Court romance. And what I say is that Stephen Breyer's impending retirement is very significant in that context, because he's the, you know, there are six former Supreme Court law clerks on the court. Breyer's the only one who clerked on the Warren Court. And that generation of scholars, you know, the Owen Fisses, the Larry Tribes, they all clerked on the Warren Court. If you go on the on Wikipedia, it has a list of every Supreme Court law clerk in history. And you go down the Warren Court law clerks, it is the legal academy of our lifetime, right? And, you know, they're being replaced by, you know, a crowd that, as you say, the brink began with Richard Nixon. Okay, 1969, or Warren is gone, Warren Burger comes. Michael Gress and I wrote a whole book about the Burger Court, which argued that, you know, passe Vincent Blasi, it was not a court where nothing happened. It was a court of, you know, substantial transition to something new. So we are at a moment of, you know, kind of culmination, you might say, of this project of our adult lifetimes. I mean, before, more than your all's adult lifetimes, but I graduated from college in 1968. And my first, the first ballot I cast was for Hubert Humphrey in 1968. So this has been my adult life. And so, you know, so maybe Brink isn't the right thing, or maybe Brink is, we're finally, you know, reaching the ultimate. The court's going to go as far as it can go. And I was very impressed by Christina Rodriguez's foreword currently in Harvard Law Review, Regime Change, where she, you know, spells out, we've got this situation where the country's going in one direction and the court's going in another, to a degree that, you know, I guess captures the last years of the Warren Court that Nixon so brilliantly exploited in his campaign. And now we're back there, and I hope we may have a Democratic leader who can exploit what's going to be happening and turn it to liberals' advantage. I have no idea whether that's a pipe dream. This is a long answer to your good question, but it's really, we're at a very fascinating moment, that's for sure.
So that's exactly where I wanted to leave up. A friend of mine texted me right after the court took cert in the affirmative action case and wrote and said, I'm quoting now from his text, he'll remain nameless. He goes, would be a bit of a Michael Corleone. Today, I settled all the family business vibe to the Supreme Court striking down Roe and affirmative action in the same term. And what this captured for me, so I was reading your book and when this happened, how much of the center of your narrative is about the legal fights that are kind of 50 years old? The meaning of Roe, Bakke, employment division versus Smith, and so on. Even the Voting Rights Act stuff, as you detail, was something that animated Justice Rehnquist and kind of early young Roberts. The conservatives on the court seem to end that, likely to end that era with some decisive victories at the court, at least for now. But what I got a lot less of is like what the court's going to do next. The book like is really focused on the kind of the long tail of the religion cases and abortion. It's all about abortion, as you say. But like that's all going to be over maybe very quickly in the like at least in the it completely plausible that it's over, that the Supreme Court kind of does affirmative action and Roe in a term. And obviously there's going to be a long tail of cases going dealing with this. But the thing that I was curious about is what, again, we're on the brink of is like, what do they do next? Which is like, is the agenda? Is you got non-delegation comes up a little bit in your thing. There's some of the property rights stuff, but where do you think the project of these new justices is going after they're done kind of winning the judicial fights of the 1970s?
Actually, I think it's pretty clear. I think it's bringing down the administrative state. And I do spend some time in the book on the Cedar Point case, the takings case, which actually has grown in significance in my mind. The day the court, a couple of weeks ago, granted the Harvard admissions case, they also granted a really important Clean Water Act case. Nobody noticed it because the Harvard case took all the air out of the room, but it's totally like the Cedar Point case in that it's Scalia's revenge. So this new case, the name of which escapes me actually, is revisiting the Rapinos case, which was a Donnybrook inside the conference early in John Roberts' tenure, the court couldn't decide this question of how you define the water, the quote, waters of the United States, and it split 4-4 to Kennedy in the middle. And the Roberts Scalia crowd lost. Either they lost Kennedy or Stevens on the other side lost Kennedy. Somebody lost Kennedy. Something happened. It was by the time the case was decided, I think it had been argued in November. It was the last undecided case of the term. So, you know, major stuff was happening. And the property rights people have been real unhappy ever since. That was 2006, I believe. And now's their chance to get back into Rapanos. So that's just one little, you know, administrative case. But this, you know, sudden emergence of this major questions doctrine, which is totally made up. Of course, originalism is totally made up, too. It's just that now we're used to it. But this is like made up in real time while we're watching. And, you know, I mean, that's going to be the name of the game. So, you know, I mean, anybody that goes through law school without taking administrative law like three times, I took it from Jeffrey Hazard when I was at YLS. And I remember, I think he really didn't want to teach it. So he offered it on Friday afternoons from 2-5, but, it filled, you know, one of the bigger classrooms. And I've, you know, this was a long time ago. So, you know, the APA was kind of fresh and new almost. But I'm certainly glad I got some of the basic ideas of administrative law, because that's where the action's going to be.
Also, by the way, as a property law professor, I recommend both thinking about Cedar Point and listening to our podcast with Nico Bowie about it, which we talked about it extensively. So you can go, listeners, you can go back and listen. I wanted to pick up on one potential strand of the kind of future-oriented jurisprudence and just see what you think. So at one point you refer to Justice Alito as engaging in more grievance conservatism. But one of the things that strikes me about the court's agenda is how different it is in structure from some of the kind of modern Republican Party politics. So, like, it's like we've talked for many years about kind of business influence on the court. But, like, right now, conservative politics has like kind of a weird mixed attitude towards big business. You've seen this in some of the kind of weird, strange, changing positions on antitrust questions. Conservative justices haven't, for the most part, picked up on kind of the woke capital critique that you see so prominently in Trumpism. You've seen a little bit of this kind of like distaste for powerful institutions. So from the kind of interest in reviving New York Times for Sullivan, or in kind of hostility towards universities. But like, I'm wondering if you think that the kind of ideological trends of the 70s and 80s are going to persist among the conservative justices, going to persist because this is where many of them come from? Or alternately, is it going to take a turn as Trumpism has taken taken conservatism on a turn? So the is it going to be the Chamber of Commerce that's the most powerful player? Or is it going to be, I don't know, you know, Tucker Carlson in the kind of future ideology of the court?
Yeah, or Edward Bloom. Or William Consovoy.
Yeah, and you mentioned a lot of these characters who kind of rose up in a different model. I mean, as a former professor at George Mason, I know all of these people, and so I the next so my former colleague Jonathan Mitchell, who's the architect of it, and then the new Solicitor General of Texas, who's going to be putting the face, Judd Stone. All of these are characters who are kind of going to be leading here, but their ideology is quite distinct from like the Chamber of Commerce stuff.
Yeah. I mean, to this point, at Axios this morning, which you probably read, has two fascinating lists. One are, you know, here's the big deals. The big deals in conservative circles like 20 years ago, and here they are today, and names you recognize, names everyone would recognize 20 years ago, names only, you know, a nerd like David Schleicher would recognize today. You might want to take a look at that.
Oh, so- I literally almost brought it up in the question. I read it this morning. It's if you don't read Axios in the morning, I honestly don't know what you're doing.
Yeah, I mean, I think one thing we haven't talked about is the weaponization of the First Amendment, which certainly serves the deregulatory appetite and has gone, I mean, I guess it has further to go, but that's gone pretty far. And that's a Chamber of Commerce project. You know, I mean, I think it was Kathleen Sullivan who argued against requiring disturbing ads on cigarette packaging as a you know, compelled speech First Amendment problem, that kind of thing. So I don't know. I don't have quite the sense of the boundaries of what some of these incipient cases are, what interests they're serving. I don't think that part of it hasn't quite gelled yet, but to the, you know, and of course, the whole story of who's for and against Chevron is so fascinating, and it you know, totally maps onto the politics of the moment. So, you know, I think what happens in our electoral politics in the next cycle is going to determine a good deal about where these justices want to take the law.
That seems right to me that, actually, it turns out that, you know, individuals can be flexible and learn new tricks. And you see that, I think, with Sam Alito and Clarence Thomas, that they are registering the novel direction of the Republican Party, especially in their responses to some COVID cases. They're definitely, I think, listening to not the Chamber of Commerce, but, you know, Fox News and other sources. But I want to step back and, you know, you're such a genius at following and educating us kind of case by case and in the book month by month. But I want to ask, how you ground your views about the proper role of the court, even ideally, if that's imaginable anymore. So I want to take off from a moment in your valedictory column, for not that you've given up writing, but you wrote a column kind of, you know, announcing the end of your regular contributions, and you've been back since. But there's an interesting passage about Robert Dahl in it, and when I tried to retrieve it this morning, you know, preparing for this, typed in Dahl Greenhouse. I was interested. There was an earlier column about Robert Dahl from 2014. And what's interesting is that there's a kind of contrast between them. The first Robert Dahl column, which we'll link in the show notes, is something of like an obituary. And you sort of say he showed there's nothing to worry about when it comes to judicial review. And if only law professors had taken him seriously, they wouldn't have had the whole debate that Alexander Bickel, you know, staged, and that, you know, Barry Friedman called an obsession. Now, you know, only a few years later, 8 years later, you write a column that is not, it has a different view. And it invokes Dahl to suggest that the trouble is that this conservative court is not keeping up with public opinion. And so at the very least, there's an anomaly to it explain. And it kind of goes back to the Brink question, because that anomaly wasn't apparent to you not very long ago. And it's apparent now. But the basic question is kind of, have you kind of changed your mind about Dahl, or the kind of exceptions to his story that the court follows public opinion? And then there's a deeper question, which is, if the court does follow public opinion, why have it? Like, why not just let, you know, legislators who've been elected more recently kind of have the last word on what the Constitution means.
Yeah. Okay. Deep stuff. Now, of course, I mean, 8 years may seem like the blink of an eye, but look at all this happened. So, of course, what's happened is the court's been captured by, minority presidents, by minority, senators representing a minority of the population. And that's a historical anomaly. It just, the three Trumpers. I think Dahl did not anticipate that, and neither did I. And I'm willing to guess neither did you, but maybe you did in your deep cynicism about the whole enterprise. I just got in the mail. I don't know who sent it to me, but it just came without a note or anything. Scott Poe's new edition of the Supreme Court and the American Elites, which takes it up through 2020. And he's still on the Dahl. I mean, I just looked at the intro last night. The book came yesterday. He still takes the Dahl, thesis, like it's going to be okay. And I think there's reason to think it's not going to be okay. We've got 75 or 80% of the public says, don't overturn Roe. Now, that strong majority group does differ in, when it's appropriate to terminate a pregnancy and under what circumstances and whatever. But at the end of the day, 80% of the American public wants to retain a right to abortion. So you can say, well, let them fight it out in the states where they live. Well, of course, we know legislatures have been gerrymandered to a fare-thee-well, and the Supreme Court has stayed its hand and has nothing to say about that. So we're really caught in a vice. And I have changed my view, because I think the facts on the ground have changed in 8 years in really a kind of a shocking way. And I don't know how that's going to play out. I really don't.
Okay, it's a great answer, and I think it was George Orwell who says, "Of course, I changed my mind. The facts changed. What would you do?" But I want to ask, did they? Because I guess you would want to say that. Well, Dahl is right, and people like Friedman, who wrote a whole book called "The Will of the People," saying there's nothing to worry about. There's no democratic problem with this judicial review or the Supreme Court. We're kind of right. It's just that there could arise this anomalous situation that we didn't expect. And there's a general case and there's a special case, and we're just in the special case now. And this matters, because if that's the right view, then we just have to figure out how to get back to normal. And you find people like my old con law professor, Lauren Stribe, who, worship the Supreme Court, as you say, as a Warren Court stan, and has come out recently as someone who's willing to entertain very radical kind of reforms to it. And, maybe that's just because we're in this anomalous situation. But what if, the supposedly anomalous situation reveals something that's, deep and enduring and structural? Then we might need different reform. So I just want to get clear on, how we're thinking about this special moment we're in now.
Right. Well, of course, all the reformers who presented themselves to the president's commission, I think, would say, yes, we're in a situation that various contingencies created and so on, but the way the Supreme Court is structured, with life tenure and its power to overturn an act of Congress by a vote of 5-4, we're stuck. There's no way out. There's no way out of it for the foreseeable future. So an anomaly turns into a permanent kind of structural misfit between, one might say, what the country needs and expects and what we've got from the Supreme Court. So I think it does require us to really have a very open mind about ideas that would have been laughed out of the park. Or I guess that Jack Balkin would say that, you know, we're totally off the wall and they're kind of sticking a little bit to the wall. I think they have to, and that's going to be a long process. But I mean, I remember when the Lindgren and Calabresi article about term limits first appeared, was it like close to 20 years ago? And I wrote about it because I thought it was just such a weird idea, you know, that I thought it was, you know, readers of the New York Times ought to know, said some, you know, conversation had been launched. But, you know, now, I guess of all the things that the commission considered, that's almost like mother's milk. Yeah, get rid of term limits. We don't know exactly how or how it would, you know, all the details of it, how we could do it, how it would work. But yeah, that's really up for grabs. And you know, it's taken a while, but it's very interesting to me that now that's become almost a default kind of reform trope, right?
Right.
So who knows what happens next?
Absolutely. I mean, in a way, it's an exciting period as well as a scary one, because kind of some orthodoxies have been shaken, or in a sense, we've said, at least for the time being, we may have to revisit what we thought. And just to continue on this line of questioning, I want to ask one more kind of about an orthodoxy that we might revisit. So, you know, earlier in the convo with David, you said the trouble with the major questions doctrine is that it's made up. And I just want to ask, isn't that true of constitutional law in general? And it gets to a deep issue because, you know, many of us sort of say when the court does what I like politically, it's doing law. And when the conservative wins, conservatives win, they're doing politics. And you know, that's one way of interpreting case after case. Maybe you put a little balance in by saying, you know, for many years at the end of every term, look, you know, it's okay because some liberal things survived or even thrived, even as the general conservative drift went further and further. But, you know, there's still this question about what's the ideal if you could have it? Is it that, you know, if there were more liberals up there, it would be like playing its proper role by interpreting the Constitution correctly, and it just happens to fit with our politics? Or was it kind of political all along, and we just liked the results more when our friends were in high places?
Yeah, you got me. I mean, I think, you know, when you put it that way, there's really not that much of an argument except from, you know, history and tradition, if I dare use those words. So, yeah, I mean, I'm thinking this goes back maybe to the previous question about orthodoxy. I guess late in Robert Bork's life, he wrote something to the extent that judicial review was illegitimate and we ought to just get rid of it. And I remember reading that thinking, you know, poor Bob Bork, from whom I took antitrust a long time ago, you know, has really lost it, that he would put his name on, you know, such a thing as this. I mean, it's like, you know, forget it. And, you know, I mean, I read your testimony and Jamal Green's and so on. You know, I don't think you're crazy. I think we've got to confront the reality of what you just said. So, you know, how we do that, or whether we give up the ghost, I don't know. But
I promise we won't entitle this episode "Bork Was Right." But this was a very interesting answer.
I think we have to hold out the possibility that Sam's crazy, just not about this particular issue. He's crazy about a whole variety of other things, but we'll leave that aside.
That's what my children say.
It's what your colleagues say. So What my personal favorite podcaster, Tyler Cowen, has a segment that he puts into all of his podcasts called Overrated or Underrated, where he asks people for quick hitting answers. But I don't want to do overrated or underrated with you, but I want to ask you a few quick hitting questions where you're going to put on your prognosticator cap and attempt to figure out what's going to happen in the Supreme Court in the next couple of years. So I'm just going to quickly see things and just see what you have to say. So first, if Roe is overturned, how will the court deal with the conflict of laws fights that are surely to follow? So when Alabama passes a law that says it's illegal for an Alabama citizen to move to go to New York to get an abortion, or when New York, Alabama sues to try to stop people from sending abortion pills from New York to Alabama. What do you think is going to happen? How is the court going to resolve the conflicts of laws questions involved with abortion?
Federalism? I don't know. You know, of course, the next fight, once they get rid of Roe, is a 14th Amendment question about whether the fetus is constitutionally entitled to a right to life. And, you know, that seems pretty off the wall to me, but, you know, that could be a whole new context.
There you go. Okay, second one. If affirmative action is overturned and Harvard loses the case, how do you think the court, do you think the court will accept policies like Texas's geographic diversity rule, or that, or other substitutes that maintain some degree of racial diversity, or are they going to block things that are designed to create racial diversity through other means?
Well, of course, you know, Fisher depends. The UT system was upheld only because Tony Kennedy was still on the court, so that's been hanging by a thread in these years. I think any policy that counts by or looks like it is counting by race is gone. The real question, I think, is obviously universities are not going to stop considering the various characteristics of the applicant pool. I mean, Harvard University is not going to go by, you know, go blindly by test scores. I mean, that's clear. In fact, many universities are abolishing the testing, you know, test as a requirement. So the Ed Blooms of the world are not going to sit idly by as it turns out that colleges are serving up entering classes that are still diverse. And so the question is, what form is that litigation going to take and what the Supreme Court's going to do about it? And I don't know the answer to that.
That's really good. So the last one, last quick hitting one, is that one of the interesting trends of the last couple of years has been kind of the rise of progressive prosecutors. So the Larry Krasners of the world in Philadelphia, Alvin Bragg in Manhattan. As of yet, we haven't seen any conflict between an extremely law and ordery Supreme Court and these prosecutors. Do you think one's coming?
Well, I don't know how, you know, totally law and ordery the court is. That's really faded. You know, those complex of issues really kind of faded on the priority list. So, you know, we've got, you might say, the Sixth Amendment has been liberalized in recent years. So I don't see a big clash coming on that score.
Well, it's been an amazing conversation. I want to invite you as a potential last question, you know, unless you want to turn it down, you know, to say it even more than you already have about the commission. You've kind of, you know, indiscreetly mentioned you're reviewing the texts, and you know, I thought an extraordinary kind of moment where you were so open about, you know, the possibilities that we have to consider, and yet the commission is doing a kind of analysis of a list, and it's not like you can't choose more than one thing from the list, but it seems as if the court reform debate has shaped up as kind of comparing and contrasting options, and so I want to just see if you want to say anything about the credibility of court packing or personnel expansion or whatever, we're now calling it versus other things.
Yeah, I guess Sam, you wrote a piece after the report came out. I, if I'm not wrong, you said, you know, maybe nothing's accomplished this month, but ideas have been put into play that, you know, down the road can flower. And I think that's true. I mean, I think the kind of dissing of the commission from its very inception, oh, it's just going to be a cover for the president so he doesn't have to do anything. And it's been, you know, completely ignored in the popular press, upon delivery. I think that's a short-term way to look at it. I think it was valuable. I think it will be valuable. It captures a kind of moment, you might say on the brink of, these kind of esteemed establishment figures who made up the commission, kind of serves it up. And I think the fact that there's close to a consensus on term limits that 20 years ago seemed like, what? This is, life tenure is essential for judicial independence. Well, no. So the jury's out on it, but I think people who write it off as like this was nothing are kidding themselves. And you might say, deep engagement with the court along these lines is, sure, it's a sign of respect for the court, but it's also a sign of concern. And I think it was net. I'm glad it happened.
Well, this was terrific. I can't recommend to all of you listeners that you Linda's new book any more than I do. It's terrific. It's a fascinating read, and this was such a fascinating conversation. So thank you so much for coming on.
Okay.
Thank you, Linda.
Bye-bye.